Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo. And oh my goodness, we're going to be going into so many areas of thought. I hope you will enjoy the adventure that we are going to be experiencing with my guest, Raven Caldera. And it is just, I think, so much fun to be involved in a way with people through their writing, to be able to travel a journey with them that maybe you'd never even dream of experiencing. And that's what this publication, Neolithic Shamanism, did for me when I was reading it. Now, this is about what would be described as spirit work. Now, how is this related to Neolithic positioning? Well, it's about the Norse people. And so many of the beliefs that we have today, believe it or not, so many of the myths and various beliefs of various institutions, especially religious institutions around the world, come from very, very ancient sources. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Raven, welcome to the show.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Raven, I had so much fun going through this book because, again, it was an adventure into the past. Now, I want people to know a little bit about you because you're, and this is how you describe yourself, a Northern tradition shaman. Now, you've been deeply involved with astrology for a lot of years. You even go so far as calling yourself pagan, which in many people's minds, you know, connote all kinds of visual images in their minds as someone that walks around without any clothes and they all they do is go duh, that they'd have the brains of a turnip, which is really, you know, pretty blah. But that's far removed. All it means is that there was a time, an understanding of the association with the environment that you lived in, and I'm using modern terminology, but it's being a part of life in a whole different dimension. So I always get a kick out of people when they choose certain words. Now, you and your wife, Galina Kraskova.
Oh, she's not my wife.
Oh, excuse me. Galina, I beg your pardon. That's my error.
She's actually, she's sworn to the god Odin, and she's married to her deity Odin. She's a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. I have a wife who's a different person.
Well, that's good to know. I'm glad to have that clarified quickly. Now, she also is a Northern tradition shaman. And she has a master's degree in religious studies from New York University. She's, you know, both of you have been involved in putting out publications. This Neolithic shamanism, I thought, is going back in time to a period when, and an environment that was very, very harsh. What got you interested in this?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I became a Northern tradition shaman because a particular goddess came and got me at a very early age when I was still a child, and I didn't know who she was. She guided me and told me to do things and taught me. And when I was in my, when I was around 30, actually, I finally figured out who she was, and her name was Hela. She was the death goddess of my ancestors. And what she was teaching me was shamanic stuff, and I didn't know it at the time, and I did eventually figure it out. And I had a near-death experience, and that was where I officially met her, as it were, or saw her face for the first time. And so in this tradition, it's not so much that you decide to be a shaman, although you can decide to be a shamanic practitioner. It's that the spirits come and get you, and they choose you. And in this country, when people hear shaman or something like that, they think Native American. That's all they think. And there's this assumption that people of European descent don't have any of that. That's not possible. And it is possible. It's just that it was lost. Mm-hmm. If you go back far enough, every culture goes back to a shamanic culture.
This is of tremendous interest to me, and I will tell you why. Because of having been involved as a counselor and a minister and interacting with people from around the world, one of the things that I became aware of, and this is going to address one of the points that you just brought out, is that we need to become aware of our cultural background, because there are genetic cellular memories that are carried forward. And in your case, you were called by, and I'll use your words, by an energy, I'll just change the word a little bit, by an energy from the past. And this stayed with you all of your life. And until you were able to truly acknowledge it as a male in your 30s, these events were probably, as they are for so many people, very difficult to understand. And the reason I can have an empathy with it is because of the people that I've interacted with through the years. I have seen this over and over and over again. So to me, the cultural aspects of shamanism apply to people around the world. It is not exclusive to any one group or any one thing. And you're correct that there's this tremendous history, this tremendous heritage. And I compliment you because in your book, you present your information about what you've become aware of in a very clear manner and one that I think can be understood. I like how you talk about how the word shaman is borrowed from the, and correct me if I mispronounce it, the Tungusic languages of Eastern Siberia and Manchuria. And that, to
yes,
me, was something I was not aware of.
Yes, people people think it's Native American, and it's not. It's Tungus. And in fact, I use that word because the word for what I do in our own ancient languages is lost. And also, even if we had it, people wouldn't understand it. But they know the word shaman, thanks to Mircea Eliade, who wrote the first book on it. And so I use that word, but I pay I pay for that word to the Siberian people. One of the things that I do is I run a website that supports the reindeer people and gives people education on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important to do because reindeer spirit is one of the ancestral spirits that came to me.
Well, this is something that, again, in my interacting with different cultures, your point of being called to this, mm-hmm, is significant because it happened. And I really like how you define in your book, Megalithic Shamanism, how there are many different applications in this positioning that, unlike what many people in the Western world of understanding is, that the shamans can be specialists. This is something where one might be very good at remote viewing. Another might be extremely good with herbs. There's another that might, you know, do well with animals or with different environments. And usually they are chosen. And often they display their talents or abilities as children, as you had the experience of. And if you were in those times when this was something that was recognized, then those that had abilities would honor and respect whatever was demonstrating in the child and encourage them to develop it. And those that I know that have gone through shamanic training have spent years in this. This isn't something that was just add water, do a little sprinkle of some kind, and boy, you got it, kid, and off you go. No, there's a tremendous responsibility that comes with this. And one of the sad things is that culturally, in many cultures, a lot of this has disappeared, as you have very clearly stated. However, in today's world, it is beginning to surface again because we are recognizing we need to honor the past and move with the wisdom of the past and move forward into the future so that we have a healthy, harmonious environment. And I think that is one of the reasons why publications like yours and many others that I've done reviews on, it's so important because it puts it out there. It takes it out of the hiding place. for so many generations, things have been hidden. Only a select few, primarily because of persecution. But this is something that you are bringing forth, you and Galena, which I think is marvelous, absolutely marvelous. Now, let's talk a little bit about how you empowered yourself with this. Did you go and seek out individuals that could help you train? What did you do? Did you walk alone in this experience?
Well, there weren't any individuals really who knew about this, and this was something that happened to Galena too, and happened to many other Northern Tradition shamans and shamanic practitioners. We sort of discovered each other later, after we'd been practicing. There's a Mongolian term called Bagshagui, which means spirit taught shaman, which happens when there's no more elders, because mm-hmm. the tradition has died off or the people have died off, and it's the spirits just up and move to some poor schmo and say, you're going to learn this. And it's much, much harder to do it that way. At least I found it to be, it was wonderful, but it was very difficult. So for a very long time, I did walk alone, and it was very hard. I almost died. And I think people don't necessarily understand that being a classic shaman, it's a full-time thing, and you are sometimes in danger of death in the beginning if you don't get trained properly, and it shapes your whole life. Your entire life is then just given over to this, and it affects everything about your life, who you can marry, who you can love, what you can put on your breakfast cereal, what you can wear, all kinds of stuff. And so I had to learn this by trial and error, and eventually I found other people who were walking the same path, also stumbling around, who had also been called, and we're sort of trying now. We put together this book and some of the other books we've written on it because there's nothing out there, because there's mm-hmm. there's nobody, there are no elders. This was all lost, and we don't want it to be lost again. And so we're writing stuff down as fast as we can in order that it not be lost.
Now, there are very interesting perspectives that I think come about here. One is personal responsibility, which is taking care of yourself, making yes. sure that you eat right, what you talked about with clothing, different aspects like this. In other words, yes. you're the vessel, so this is your responsibility. And if you don't do this, then you're going to pay a heavy price. Also, yes. you talk about psychic hygiene, mind yes. hygiene, and boy, is that a big one. That is a yep. big one. Address that a little bit.
Well, if you're doing this for a living, and basically to be a shaman is, or even a shamanic practitioner, is to have a service job where you take clients and you serve the public. You have a responsibility to be as clean and clear as you can, because they're depending on you to be an intermediary and to get the messages correct. And if you've got a huge amount of undealt baggage, every piece of baggage you carry clouds your signal clarity. We found that with terms of what you put in your body, eating a lot of chemicals clouds your signal clarity. So there's all sorts of things that can mess with your signal clarity, and it is our responsibility as practitioners to do our very best to make sure that we are as clear as possible, and that's hard. That's full-time maintenance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. Now let's talk about, and we're only going to be able to touch on a few things here, but let's talk about ley lines. This is something sure. that people will toss out periodically, and I once knew a gentleman, he's passed away now. This was his area of expertise, and sure. he would talk about the ley lines, and he would be very explicit with someone. For example, if they were going to buy a home, he'd say, you don't want certain things in a home because it is going to cause problems, water running a certain direction underneath the house and all of these kinds of things. And I found his conversation very interesting. And in your book, you address ley lines. Why are ley lines? First of all, what are they? And for those that may not have ever heard of the terms, and then why are they significant?
Well, they're lines of energy that run through the earth. If you know anything about acupuncture and you've ever seen pictures of the acupuncture meridians in a human body, the ley lines are kind of like the meridians of the earth. And there's positive and negative ley lines. That doesn't mean good and bad. It means pushes up and pulls down. And so a pushing up one will have a certain energy, and a pulling down one will have a certain energy. You wouldn't want to have that under your bedroom because it would cause insomnia. You wouldn't want to have a pulling down one under your kitchen. You'd want to put that under your compost heap, things like that. If you have a really huge ley line, they come in from tiny, 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 like the size of your finger, to, I've seen ones that are 10 feet wide in rare cases, and I've seen earth-moving situations where they were putting in houses and condominiums and so forth, where they've ripped into a ley line and put a bunch of condos right on top of it, and then the people, it's just too much energy. And the people get ill in various ways because that oughtn't to have been built on, and that is certainly true. I think it all part of the problem is we are so unaware of our environment and so detached from nature that we think it's just a sheet of plastic we can do anything with, and that's not true. The earth does have its own energies, and you really do have to respect that when you're going to go digging into it and trying to live on top of it.
You have a section in your book that when I read it, I went, oh, my goodness, this is wonderful because people need to understand this. In the Western world, there has often been promoted that being vegetarian is more spiritual than being a meat eater, which I don't agree with at all. I never have. I respect the people that believe that. But you bring a point out in your book, all life feeds on life. And I've said that so many times. And your comment is that plant life is just as alive as animal life. And it is all meant to empower us. And the Norse tradition, the Norse people, they had a very hard life. Their environment reminds me a great deal of what it was like in Alaska. You have a few months, maybe, if you're lucky. You've got to take advantage of that. But it is tough to be able to feed yourself. You can't grow crops like you could in Southern California. You have a whole different world that you deal with. And you said that this is something that the spirits of that environment, there was no taboo because survival meant you had to utilize whatever was in the environment. And that has always been true. And it's only been recently, when you really look at the history of things, that we have had such a prolific abundance because of technology and other components. And here we are today, now we're saying we have a toxicity in food because we haven't done things properly. But I really respect that positioning that you have mentioned because I think there needs to be a grounding. There needs to be a reality and an understanding about life. That's very important, and that is a very powerful message that you give in your book. And you have a chapter called The Green World, and I have to bring this one up, mugwort. I thought of Harry Potter as soon as I came to that section. I said, oh, this is just incredible. Tell us about mugwort and its historical positioning and why it is so valuable as part of the Green World.
Well, I'm a plant shaman. Some shamans really have a relationship with lots of animals, and well, I've got a couple of animals I got relationships with. Mostly, it's plants for me. I'm a herbalist, and I love the plants and the plant spirits. And I started talking to plant spirits at a very young age, and mugwort has always been one of my friends. It grows as a weed. Mugwort is a sacred plant. Ancient Europeans, Western Europeans, used it the way that modern Native Americans and ancient Native Americans use white sage. It's a smudging plant. It makes sacred space. The two big smudging plants of Europe were mugwort and juniper. So I grow a lot of mugwort. It grows wild here, and I make smudge sticks of it. We call that, in our tradition, we call it reckoning. basically, the spirit of Mugwort, she's this very lunar, witchy old grandma, and she that's how she comes across to me, anyway. And she basically uses her magic to clean and purify a space. And I love Mugwort to pieces. I haven't found the space yet that she can't help.
Now, nettle. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we have stinging nettle. And boy, that plant is a tough one to get up and get out. But it has the most beautiful flowers on it. But it is a plant you don't want to bump into because it will really cause problems. And it's really a problem for horses. But I got an education about nettle because it was significant in the Bronze Age to the Danish people. Why?
Well, first of all, people ate nettles. They're perfectly safe once they're cooked. And people ate nettles for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years. It's an incredibly nourishing plant. It's got a big old taproot that goes down and pulls the minerals out of the soil. It's medicinally, it's used for all kinds of things. It's one of those plants that has about 50 uses and will really help what ails you. It was a spring tonic. People would come out of the horrible cold winters of Europe and of Northern Europe, and they would need a spring tonic to make up for the fresh greens they hadn't been able to make. And nettles comes up pretty quickly in the springtime. And it was like a giant vitamin and mineral pill, and it also helps the body to get rid of its own wastes. It helps your kidneys to function better, and so it's really wonderful. I know that in medieval times, it was said about a chef that the best chefs knew how to make 20 different dishes with a nettle top. So it's just that today we think of it as a nasty weed, but the nettle plant, the spirit of the nettle plant, is a fiery soldier that is out to help and protect you. And I actually have a patch of nettles right by my door, my front door, that is my door guard. And their job, they've agreed to be there, and their job is to attack anyone who is going to try to enter my house with ill intent.
Amazing. Now, let's talk about animals for a moment, because I think many people in today's world identify with animals, and one of my favorites is a squirrel, and of course we have an abundance of them here in our backyard, as well as so many other beautiful creatures, but the squirrel, I thought, was just so much fun, and you said your wife loves the squirrel.
Yes, she does.
And
she does.
She really relates to it. And in Norse mythology, it was a sacred animal. Why?
Well, in Norse mythology, we have the world tree, which the idea is that there's nine worlds with all the different different magical pantheons and species and that revolved around it. And there's a dragon at the bottom and an eagle at the top. And often, it's not unusual to find in many other mythologies the same idea of the world tree with the dragon at the bottom and the eagle at the top. And the squirrel is the messenger that runs between them. The sacred squirrel's name is Ratatosk. And he runs up and down and delivers messages. And so squirrels are seen as this divine messenger in that sense. And the idea is that the squirrel spirit is the interpreter and shows up when somebody's trying to tell you something and you need to listen.
You go into other animals, and I know that your associate, Galina, really has some wonderful statements about different animals. And you go into goats. You talked about, you've got specific ones that you cover. Also, there is a point that surprised me that you put in your book, and it was relative to tanning, because one of the ways to protect yourself against the bitter, bitter winters in the northern environments was by using animal skins, and there's nothing the equivalent of it. I mean, you have a fur that comes from either the reindeer or the bear or any of your animals that have a heavy coat, even the wolf. This is something that can insulate you and protect you and was highly regarded. But this is something that among all shamanic traditions that you respect, and you talk about how this is done, but I found in your information on the tanning of skin, there was an oak bark tanning, and I've never heard of the oak bark tanning. Let's talk about that for just a minute.
Oh, well, there's a lot of tannin in oak bark. That was one of the earliest, simplest ways to do it, along with using brains and things like that. Today, of course, tanning is generally done with chemical processes. But we wanted to talk about what we did with Neolithic shamanism is we put a craft into every chapter, except for the chapter on craft, which has a lot of different crafts. And we really wanted to do a craft for the chapter on animals, and what better than tanning? We put in the oak bark tanning because that's, it's a very old process that we'd like not to be lost. So part of what we're doing is we're just putting out information on these old processes. And I think the whole point of the shamanic worldview, and anyone can have a shamanic worldview, is that you are in right relationship with all the all parts of the earth, all parts of existence. And being in right relationship with animals means not wasting. Like you were saying earlier, it's not only perfectly legitimate. There is a sacredness to eating meat in our shamanic tradition. But part of that is right relationship, and right relationship means you buy organic whenever possible, because it's disrespectful to both plants and animals the way that agribusiness is done, and you don't waste it. I do. Not everyone has to, but I do actually have my own goats and sheep. I live on a farm, and I raise goats and sheep and chickens. And when we do butcher some of the young males, and we try to use every part of them. And that includes the skin. The hooves become rattles and ornaments. The skulls are used in various decorative ways. There's all kinds of things that you can do with every part of the animal. And so the idea is not to waste.
Well, I know we're just about out of time. Your book has so much information in it. And I would say for the curious, it's a wonderful read, Neolithic Shamanism. For those that are aware of aspects of shamanism and wanted to explore a different perspective of it, I think this is great. I love the details about the herbs, about the animals. You go into what is called the brown world, the blue world, the gray world, and the black world, which represents the ancestors. So many wonderful perspectives that no matter what a person's cultural background is, it will touch a point of harmony inside. So whether you have a Japanese background, an Italian background, Greek, Norse, African, it makes no difference. I think what it means is that we need to honor and respect the diversity, number one, that we have within our world, and number two, that every aspect has something to give us in the way of a gift, the gift of understanding. And I think, again, your book, Neolithic Shamanism, goes a long way to be bringing this information forth. And, Raven, what is your website so people can find out more about what you do and more of Galena's work?
My shamanism website is northernshamanism.org, www.northernshamanism.org. And my website for all my books and stuff is ravencaldera.org.
All right. So northernshamanism.org or ravencaldera, KALDERA.org. Raven, thanks ever so much. It's been a delight having you as a guest, and I wish you continued success with this because your book is just power-packed with information. You and Galena have done a wonderful job.
Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be taking a break for a moment. Don't forget, Neolithic Shamanism. If you're building a library, if you want to explore, have an adventure into perspective that you're intrigued with, why not check it out? Doesn't hurt. Remember, the more you expand your world, the more you're open to learning new things. the richer you become. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Hey, telephone lines are going to be open now, so if you wanted to give me a buzz, call me at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I'm always intrigued by the various cultural patternings of people, and I'm intrigued even more with the commonalities, regardless of where you are in the world. Now, I know that there was a drop for a moment of a connection, so let me give you Raven Caldera's information again. You can go to Raven Caldera. org, and that's K-A-L-D-E-R-A, if you're interested in the Neolithic shaman. You can find out more about Raven, what he does. And then northernshamanism.org is the website. Those are the two websites that you can check out. But the reason I'm so intrigued with this is because I'm of Italian background, Italian-Germanic background. And in the German history, there's just all kinds of Norse tradition and information, and of course, it's that part of the world. In the Italian tradition, you have other things that have come in. And of course, when you look at the environmental perspective, the German environment, very harsh, very stoic. The Italian environment is more sunny. It has got a variation. They've got the Alps, you know, right there in Italy, so you can have bitter, bitter cold. But there's a different feel about Italy. I have yet to encounter anyone that has gone into areas of Italy where there isn't this happiness. It's with food. It is an attitude about love. There's just so many things. But they have their stuff, too. Every place has its own magic. That's how I'll describe it. It also has the side that's not so magical, that can be very oppressive. But in each of these cultural environments, and of course this is part of my genetic disposition, along with a few other things that somebody threw in along the way, I'm more like a Heinz 57, but those are two of the stronger factors in my genetic packaging. And through the years, I have found it interesting to observe, to look at this. And I recall a program that was done by the Smithsonian. All of us are aware of this, the Smithsonian Museum and the phenomenal displays they have and the historical material that they've got. And they will address the shamanistic aspect because it's around the world. And they did an exploration in Africa. And this is a program, oh my goodness, I don't even remember when it was put on television, but so many years ago. And they sent a group of people over into a particular area of Africa. I honestly don't remember what section, northern, southern, east, west, I don't remember. When they started interviewing and talking with the shamans, there they were called witch doctors, I was so fascinated with what they found out. One, the people went through tremendous training. This one shaman, who was very much, I'll call him a shaman, it's one witch doctor, was an herbalist. He had a large square platform that was out in an open area. People who were ill would come in to see him, and they would wait their turn because he would talk with them, and he would work with them. They found that this man had memorized the equivalent of 3,000 plants so that he could assist the people that came to see him. So he had to learn a level of diagnosis. Now, stop and think of something. A good physician in the Western world basically spends 16 years to become what we consider knowledgeable. This is a long period of time. Would you agree? I think you would. So any real skill, any defining skill, is something that you have to put time into. I don't care whether it's the making of a guitar or becoming a shaman. Anything and everything in between. It takes time because there is a refinement, a sophistication that comes because you have to have practical experience and hopefully you'll have mentors. Now, Raven and Galena, I have walked a route, and I can relate to this, where you're basically pretty much alone as you evolve through your growing. But you find things come your way, that there will be influences that direct you or give you information so that you become astutely aware of what needs to be done. Well, going back to Africa, not only did they interview this witch doctor who was so knowledgeable about herbs, but they had concern because with the growth of population, many areas where a lot of these plants were that the witch doctors for centuries had used to assist the people that were there, they were disappearing because of the human population growth. And again, this was many years ago. They also found this very elderly lady, and these people were highly respected. And this elderly lady, she must have been all about 4'3", tiny, tiny woman, very. You know what they found out? That she was a phenomenal psychiatrist. And that she, like the kahunas of Hawaii, would be very aware of a person and would listen carefully and would get to the core cause of whatever the illness was. And I remember specifically in the film, there was a young woman that was going through tremendous physical pain. And the old woman understood that a lot of her pain was emotional. And so she did a particular ritual, and in dealing with this, and those that were interpreting things and were passing along the information to those from the Smithsonian, she had nailed the emotional base of the cause of the illness, and then worked with this young woman so that this could be released and how to do what was necessary to release it. Again, putting together a ritual. They seemed to be so surprised that this old woman was so astutely aware of the mental workings of this young person. And I just had to chuckle. Because so many times we have this arrogance where we think, oh, gee whiz, these people, because they don't live the way we do and it's not according to our standard, boy, they really can't know very much. Very wrong. I've learned a long time ago that you don't throw stones at any culture. You take time to learn it. You may not agree with certain things, and perhaps their cycle has to phase out because it no longer suits the world that we live in. But it is something you don't disregard wisdom because it comes in a different color or in a different nationality or in a sexual aspect, male or female. You don't do that. The wise person will say, what can I learn from this? What is something that is going to bring benefit into my life and into the lives of the people I associate with? And the common thread that I have found in every single one of them is personal responsibility, having integrity, and being willing to learn and having adaptability. All of these are components that are just as important today as they have been throughout the millennia. It makes a difference. And this is part of what we're going through right now. We're having to learn. We're having to adapt. We are forcing ourselves to wake up to the fact that certain patterns are no longer acceptable, that we have to shift and change. Do we like it? I don't know. Sometimes we kick like mules, don't we? At least I have at times. And if you're like me, sometimes you have an open line to the universe, which everybody does, and you say, I'm sorry, but I just don't get it. I keep getting put on hold. It just doesn't make me feel very good. Well, sometimes being put on hold is important so you can learn whatever you need to learn right where you are. Donna Sebo, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. Now, tomorrow's going to be an open mic day. My guest that was going to be on the air with me is not able to make it, so tomorrow's going to be open mic, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of things. Also, on Friday, we're going to go into an experience. I've never done it. Have you ever done tracking of animals or people? Well, it was something that was very significant when it came to the hunters of old, and people still are interested in it. And they go and they train with a man by the name of Tanarak Song. Now, we're going to be entering the mind of the tracker. Fascinating stuff. So tell your friends, and I hope you can join me. And we've got guests coming up, and we're going to be talking about Atlantis. We're going to be talking about how men can improve their lives and food and, so many other things. And I invite you to join me. Donna Sebo here, 888-627-6008. And quickly, I want to mention to those of you that are listening from the state of Alaska, I want you to know I'm going to be in Fairbanks and in Anchorage. I will be in Fairbanks from April the 29th until May the 2nd, and then from May 2nd in the evening until May 6th. And if you'd like to reach me to set a private session with me while I'm in town, and I'm going to be doing some shows while I'm up there as well, plus this show while I'm on the road. So just give me a call at 253-582-5604. Well, a little bit of whimsical stuff here. Do you have favorite flowers? It's springtime. What is it that when you're out, if you're like me, you like them all? But there maybe is a flower that you really resonate with. Tulips are coming out here in the Pacific Northwest. They're always spectacular. What about lilies? Well, in the Pacific Northwest, they come out usually later, at least in our backyard. Usually they come out in the June, July period. It all depends on how much sun we have. Peonies, lilacs, hyacinths, and daffodils, of course. They're in season here, and they're pretty yellow faces. I just love to see them. We have some neighbors that have put in just dozens of them, and they're just wonderful. Well, what I'm going to do is share with you a little bit of insight into flowers and their meaning. So we'll be coming back after break with that. And again, we're going to take just a real quick break here. 888-627-6008 is the telephone number for you to call in. All I need from you is your first name or your initial. And then let me tell you what I perceive. You know, I do like to know what part of the country or the world you're calling in from. So give me a buzz at 888-627-6008. 6008. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. I want to share a recipe with you, too. This is with asparagus, and asparagus is coming out here in our markets, and they're just beautiful. Now, I like asparagus plain or, to me, it's just delicious as a vegetable all by itself. And, of course, when you're fixing asparagus and you're breaking off the wooden part, you're going to find that that wooden part, actually, if you want to make a soup, if you'll just dice it real finely, then you can make a good soup stock with it. And it's just wonderful. It's absolutely great. But I wanted to share this recipe with you quickly. And this is with a lemon caper sauce. And if you like to have something that's a little fancy, you can use the capers. If you don't like capers, forget the capers. But this is a fresh herb sauce. It's wonderful. Now, you're going to need about 1.5 pounds of asparagus and just trim off the tough ends. Actually, if you hold an asparagus in your hand and just bend it, the tough will just pop right off. You're going to need a tablespoon of olive oil and chopped fresh dill. Now, if you don't have the fresh, you can use the dried, but the fresh just has an entirely different flavor. It's the oils of the dill that just give it this incredible pop in your mouth of taste. You're going to need a teaspoon of chopped fresh tarragon. Again, if you don't have the fresh, you can use the dry. A half a teaspoon of grated lemon zest, again, fresh versus dry, but it's up to you. You use what you have, right? Right. And you need a tiny bit of salt, a tiny bit of pepper, and you're going to need a half a cup of mayonnaise. Now, if you want to keep this a little bit less calorically, because the sauce is really what adds the calories, asparagus hardly have any calories in them at all, so you can use light mayonnaise. Or if you want the richer, you use the regular mayonnaise. You're going to need a tablespoon of chopped fresh parsley, tablespoon of chopped drained capers. They're very salty, but they still are very good, and a tablespoon of fresh lemon juice. Now, you could steam your asparagus. You could do that if you wanted to. But what about roasting them? That's right. Now, this is what you do. This is what makes this recipe so different. You're going to roast your asparagus. Your oven has to be heated to 425 degrees. You're going to line a rimmed baking pan with foil. And in a bowl, you put your asparagus along with your olive oil, your dill, your tarragon, your lemon zest, a little bit of salt and pepper. Just mix it until all of the asparagus has that light coating of oil. And then you want to put your asparagus in a single layer on your baking sheet. You roast them for 20 minutes. And you'll know that they're done because when you put a fork in them, it's very tender. The fork goes right into the asparagus. You don't want to overcook the asparagus. And then in a little bowl, while that is cooking, you take your mayonnaise, your parsley, your capers, your lemon juice, add the remaining 1/4 teaspoon of lemon zest and just a tiny bit of pepper. You might want to use white pepper here instead of your black pepper. Your choice. And voila! You got your meal. You've got asparagus, and you put some sauce over it. Beautiful presentation. Wonderful for the taste buds. It just is perfect. So I wanted to share that with you because asparagus, I got a big batch sitting in my refrigerator, and I'm going to do this recipe. I just love it because it is so easy, so simple, and it tastes so good. Do you notice when the weather starts getting warmer, you want lighter food. You really don't want the real heavy dishes. And, of course, vegetables are coming out, and they're just such a joy, absolutely a joy to have. I told you I'd share with you the meaning of flowers, and this is a survey. And I will share with you that one of the things that I learned to do many years ago, and I don't do it very often, is to have a class situation where people will bring in flower arrangements that they put together. And they don't have to be of any particular size, but I'll say you choose the flowers, you arrange them in the container of your choice. And when I have a class like this, people will bring it in. I don't want to see who's brought in what, so usually I stay outside. And then I'll come in after everybody's arrived, and then I do a reading of the flowers. And, oh, is it insightful? It is amazing what you can tell about a person. And I did a class like this last year, and the individuals that attended the class, they didn't know what to expect, and it just blew them away. It is so much fun. So when I came across this in this particular survey that had been done, yes, you know me in surveys, they found that people that like certain flowers, and of course there's so many types, so we're only going to be talking about a few, they have a predisposition in their personality for certain things. And, of course, daffodils. Anybody that loves daffodils, you need to be aware of the colors. But let's just take the simple yellow daffodil, which to me is just exquisite. Did you know daffodils have fragrance? There are those that do, and it's exquisite. I never knew daffodils had a fragrance. They do. And daffodils are the announcer of spring. Crocus usually comes up in the Pacific Northwest before the daffodils do. But usually, people who love daffodils, they have very open, honest dispositions. They're just absolutely nurturing, and they have this attitude about life. The flowers reflect them. You think of the stem on the daffodil, it's tall, it's rich green, and that beautiful, bright, bright yellow that just makes everything seem to come alive by its very energy. Now, peonies are another flower, which are exquisite. And what they found in their survey, they say peonies are to spring what roses are to summer. It's a romantic flower. People love to have them in bridal bouquets. They have outsized petals. They are packed together. The blooms are exquisitely lush and full. And this people that really are attracted to peonies find that they believe in the future. They really have faith and trust that life is going to be good to them, and they believe in taking the time to do what's necessary to build a firm foundation. Now, tulips, yes, they're coming up and coming out here in the Pacific Northwest. I don't know about your part of the world, but elegance is associated with a tulip. That's right, elegant mystery. And a tulip, well, it often is perceived as being half shut, not totally open. Usually at the end of their cycle, they open and the petals spread completely. So the person that really is attracted to the tulip is someone that maybe will keep secrets until you earn their trust before they open up totally. They can be very alluring, the person that loves the tulips. Lilacs, oh, they are gorgeous. They smell awesome. Creative visionary is the association made with lilacs because they come in different shades of purple. Some of them are a purple blue, even white. There are white lilacs as well. And this is a person that if you really love lilacs, you're very creative. You are very patient. You know, lilacs will take years to bloom after they're first planted. So you really are willing to do what's necessary to achieve what you want. Hyacinths, you like novelty. Yes, they come in a spectrum of colors. You love variety. You're not afraid to step out into the unknown. And, of course, they are just blooming everywhere right now. The lilies, serenity. Yes, person that loves lilies, they say when the petals burst open, they're like a star, and it reflects someone that has an open, warm-hearted spirit. And of course, in many cultures, they are symbolic of purity and serenity, a symbol of grace under pressure. You're not afraid to go after what you need to go after, and you will always be poised and aware of what you're doing. I just thought that would be fun to share with you. This is Donna Sebo. My goodness, we're already out of time. Join me tomorrow. This is going to be an open mic day tomorrow. So we're going to be talking about all kinds of things, but more importantly, I would love to chat with you. So remember, you can call in at any time during the show tomorrow because we are not going to be having a guest. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. If nothing else, I would like for you to give yourself the gift day of maybe learning something new. Open your mind and your attitudes to saying, what can I learn today that I never knew about before? Don't be afraid to step into an area of the unknown, whether it's with cooking, mechanics, shamanism, I don't care. Be willing to learn. You'll be richer because of it. And oh my goodness, you're going to find that you will touch the lives of others, perhaps in a very special way, because you've been willing to step outside of your box. This is Donna Sebo. I'll be with you tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.